The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to the authenticity question in politics. Here's David Plotz, host of Slate's Political Gabfest podcast, speaking with guest Julia Yoffe about candidate Hillary Clinton.
She seems to be running a very analogous campaign to the one she ran in 2007, 2008, where she's super stilted, very cautious, very scared of the press, and being very calculated about, you know, how much of her real self she lets show.
But what is it? What do you even mean, her real self? Like, why is it important to identify a real self?
You would think she would have learned that lesson, that she should at least put on a good show of authenticity, but she's still, you know, she's still like, oh no, I'm just learning it right now, and I will start later.
Clinton is just one of many contenders who's been fighting to appear authentic in the eyes of the media and American voters, pushing against the stuffy, snobbish insider persona that's become especially reviled in this election cycle and given non-politicians an edge. But what does authentic really mean in politics? Well, not that much, according to University of Denver political scientist Seth Maskett. Seth is also a columnist for Pacific Standard magazine, where he's been writing about the role authenticity plays in politics. And Seth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
American voters and the media now seem to be obsessed with authenticity. What does that mean?
Well, we're not really sure what it means, but it doesn't seem to mean the word authentic in any sense. And that is, you know, when we hear reporters using, as in that clip, the term put on a show of authenticity. Authentic, at least my impression, is that it's supposed to mean whatever the person really is. And here we're talking about someone basically they needing to put on a show, to portray something that they may not already be, and that will be considered authentic.
Which makes me wonder. I mean, authentic suggests a person who's maybe human, you know, has cranky moments, gets tired, maybe stumbles. So do people, voters, really want authenticity?
It's not clear that they do. I mean, it's really difficult to test this, of course. I mean, it's hard to go back in time and just sort of say, well, which presidential candidates were actually authentic, and we could see whether the authentic candidate won or not. I mean, the problem with it is that it's a word we tend to impose retroactively on past elections and say, well, George W. Bush beat Al Gore because he was the more authentic candidate. But, you know, at the time, you could make a case that either one of them had authenticity problems, in that, you know, they were both Yale-educated, Harvard-educated, sons of wealthy politicians, who were both affecting Southern accents to win an election. And one of them happened to get a few more votes, or at least a few more electoral votes than the other. It's not necessarily that, you know, voters preferred one over the other because they believed his story more. There's, you know, other parts of elections that seem to be much more convincing, like the state of the economy or who's perceived as a moderate or an extremist.
Well, here is one moment that has been held up as a very genuine one on the campaign trail, although not quite really on the campaign trail in this case. It's Joe Biden speaking with Stephen Colbert on The Late Show.
I don't think any man or woman should run for president unless, number one, they know exactly why they would want to be president, and two, they can look at the folks out there and say, I promise you, you have my whole heart, my whole soul, my energy, and my passion to do this. And I'd be lying if I said that I knew I was there. I'm being completely honest.
Well, that moment won a lot of people over, including the columnist David Brooks, who says, yes, he should run for president. He's so genuine, authentic, by saying that he couldn't possibly run and be authentic. So this creates this kind of circular problem. They're politicians at heart who have to convince Americans that they have no desire to be part of a system that voters love to hate. What's going on?
Exactly. Yeah, part of the problem is that, you know, we have an instinctive distrust for politicians. And so anyone who tells you they don't want to be a part of the system, we immediately think, aha, they need to be part of the system, which creates sort of a problem. The other side of it is that when you're running for office in a democracy, you know, the idea is to win a great many votes. And that means, you know, winning over people who believe different things. And so candidates who are seriously in the game and trying to do it, they will try very hard to not offend a lot of potential voters. And in their effort not to do that, it can sound like they're not saying what they really mean. And they're not necessarily lying to us. They're simply trying to put together a large coalition of people. But to some, that sounds inauthentic. It sounds like they're putting on a show when we really want to hear what they truly believe. But of course, it's not always clear what someone really believes or what someone really is. There's not just one thing that Hillary Clinton exactly is, or there's not just one thing that any given voter really is. We're a wide range of beliefs and background.
You do remind us in your most recent column that Hillary Clinton has been living in the public eye for more than two decades now. But people keep throwing questions like, is she being authentic? Is he, but really mostly she? Does this obsession with authenticity apply to women more than men?
That is something I wonder. And we don't have a lot of sense of this at the presidential level. I mean, there simply haven't been that many female presidential candidates who have come this close to the office before. But, you know, if you look at maybe, you know, congressional candidates, I think of like Patty Murray or Tammy Duckworth, these are certainly candidates who one might think of as authentic in the sense that, you know, they've had sort of real life experiences. They're not necessarily lifelong politicians. But at the presidential level, it might be different. Hillary Clinton has been labeled as inauthentic several times that she's run and in several other places throughout her political life. And that may just be directed at her because she's her. It may be directed at her because she's a woman. We don't have a great many cases to look at.
Well, Hillary Clinton's campaign announced that it's going to start being more spontaneous and fun. You know, sounds a little bit like planning spontaneity. So what do you think, Seth Masket? Good show of authenticity?
Well, I mean, I think it's challenging for female candidates. It's particularly challenging for Hillary Clinton running for president. I mean, we saw lots of examples of this in 2008 where she was always trying to sort of thread the needle between being seen as too masculine and too feminine, between as too emotional or too unemotional. No matter what she did, she was getting criticized for being too much of one thing and not the other. So, you know, she was criticized as being too calculating and too unemotional. And then we saw a, you know, right before the New Hampshire primary in 08, a display of emotion, a sort of a spontaneous bit of crying in an interview at a diner. And actually, voters seemed to resonate to that somewhat. Her approval ratings went up. She actually went on to win that primary. But then there were concerns that, oh, well, maybe this isn't appropriate for a president to be crying. And so then she had to move in the other direction. It places a lot of pressure on her to try and show who she really is, even though she basically is who she is. We've been seeing her publicly for more than 20 years now. We have a pretty good sense of what her personality is.
Well, Seth, thank you for speaking with us today.
It's been good talking to you. Thank you.
Seth Masket, political scientist at the University of Denver and author of No Middle Ground, How Informal Party Organizations Control Nominations and Polarize Legislatures, and columnist for Pacific Standard Magazine, where we read several of his columns about the role of authenticity in politics. However loaded the term is during campaign season, authentic is habitually used when it comes to food. Its meaning and use in the restaurant industry is so uncertain that longtime food critic Bill Addison refers to it as the A word. Bill is restaurant editor for Eater. Producers Molly Donahue and Taylor Quimby spoke to him about the riddle of authentic cuisine.
So, Bill, I'm going to give you a little riddle, actually. We're going to start. I want you to picture walking down a street in some New England town, and you see a restaurant, let's call it Los Amigos, and it says authentic Mexican cuisine. Now, what do you think that means?
Well, I think it doesn't mean much of anything, really, probably. But what I think they're trying to get across is that if you eat here, you'll understand the real flavors of Mexico. And I have several questions when I see a sign like that. First of all, there is no one real, quote, authentic Mexican cooking, unquote. There are cuisines in Mexico, plural.
Right.
And cuisines that come down not to just a region, but a town, a neighborhood, a household. So I actually sort of cringe when I see that word authentic splashed across a restaurant's facade.
So it sort of seems like the word has been co-opted. You know, big companies use authentic to mean something even less significant.
Yeah. Like, what, you know, when you see it on, like, frozen food.
Right. And it's funny because America's had such a funny swing in culture over the last 50 years around food. And by funny, I mean peculiar and fascinating. Not actually funny. You know, maybe in the 1950s, we were as a culture so myopic that we wanted food that sounded perhaps exotic, but was really familiar to our palate with just a little hint of exoticism in some way. You know, a fondue pot or a splash of cumin to mean Mexican food. But as Americans have taken more of an interest in food, this word authenticity and authentic has become much more enticing. We want to believe that there's somebody's grandmother back there cooking the food that she grew up with in a small town in a faraway country. And so the corporate giants have seen that, and so they have absolutely co-opted this word authentic to broadcast, hey, you know, you're getting the real deal when you buy this food product from us.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, when I was thinking about the, you know, you're walking down the street, you see a Mexican restaurant, it says authentic Mexican cuisine. I start thinking about all the different things it could mean. You know, you sort of talk about the recipe, the tradition, but like you mentioned, there's also the people who are cooking it. Like, are they authentically Mexican? And then there's even like, is this stuff sourced from Mexico? So it could be about an ingredient
sure.
list.
Even if it meets all those qualifications, it's not even authentic enough for some people.
Yeah.
Right. And yes, exactly. So there's A, is the cook in the back, even if they are Latino or, you know, of Hispanic origin, are they cooking recipes like they themselves would cook for their family, or are they adopting things to the perceived clientele? And then conversely, is the clientele buying into the fact that it's authentic, or are they resentful that it's not Oaxacan cuisine or Baja, you know, food? It's just, yeah, the mind can go round and round and round and round on this stuff.
It's a total can of worms.
So do you think there is food that can be 100% authentic?
No, I think that when it comes to food, that generally authenticity is a myth. I think that, you know, part of the romance of food writing these days is food writers and television personalities traveling to the source for these kinds of dishes that we're all curious about, whether it be Japan or Lebanon or, you know, Oaxaca. And I think that if you take food out of its place of origin, if you're not cooking it with the food grown in the soil around where this recipe evolved, or if you're not cooking it in a family setting where maybe there are multiple contributions to the recipe or something that's passed down by word of mouth and you're trying to translate into a professional kitchen, I think the whole subject of authenticity can be lost in all that.
We read your article, Magical Realism, about going to Disney World, and it really made you question the meaning of authentic food. So as a food critic, where do you stand on Disney cuisine?
What I find fascinating about Disney, it is the microcosm for thinking about this subject of authenticity and food. Three of us from Eater went down to do a big package covering sort of every angle food-wise of Disney World. And while we were particularly wandering around Epcot, you know, we found ourselves always questioning, like, how, you know, close to the source was this Chinese dish? How true to Canada was the poutine, which is a snack of fries with gravy and cheese curds on top. I was there for 5 days of research and ordered food at about 53 different establishments, which
wow.
was one of the hardest. It felt military at the end. It was one of the hardest assignments I've ever had. But what I began to appreciate, you know, of course not everything is going to be quote-unquote authentic at Disney World, but I do appreciate that Epcot, in particular at Disney World, can open a window of curiosity. When I was a kid myself, and I went there in the 80s, I ate the French food in the France Pavilion, and I was curious to go to France myself because something about the food, the crunch of the baguette or the unctuousness of the French onion soup made me want to try those things at the source. And so I guess that's my greatest hope for people visiting Disney. You know, for a lot of people, their encounters at Morocco or China or Japan may be as close as those countries that they ever get.
So maybe then let me pose like an alternative interpretation for the word. Maybe it's not so much about any of those specific qualities that we talked about as it is about like an experience. Like if you have an authentic experience, like you feel like you walked away having eaten Mexican food, and it felt, you know, it felt like an authentic moment. That's what we're going for.
I think so. I like to use the word, you know, the other thing is, of course, like we just said, you know, even as a food critic, I'm always chasing something that's as close to the source as possible when we're talking about global foods or even foods from the South where I live. You know, does something taste authentically of Cajun cuisine in Louisiana? Does it taste of Creole cuisine right in New Orleans? So I like to use the phrase true-minded instead of authentic when I'm writing about these kinds of foods, because I think that gets more to the point that somebody is looking for the most accurate, honest sense of cooking a dish and experiencing it.
And that was the food critic Bill Addison speaking with producers Molly Donahue and Taylor Quimby. Addison is restaurant editor at Eater. And you'll find a link to read his piece about authenticity and Disney cuisine at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Forgery in the art industry is not rare, but a con artist who's been caught and never sent to jail is. Meet Mark Landis. For more than 30 years, he's been imitating works of artists ranging from Picasso to Mary Cassatt to Dr. Seuss, and donating them to more than 46 museums in 20 states. The documentary Art and Craft gives us a glimpse of Landis, the mischievous shut-in and skilled artist who played the role of philanthropist, along with a curator who was bent on stopping him. Jennifer Grossman and Sam Kalman directed the film, which recently made its debut on PBS's POV series, and is now available to watch online. Jennifer and Sam, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So how would you describe Mark Landis?
Mark is not like anyone I've ever met before. And, you know, when we first read the article in the Times that sort of inspired us to make the film, we didn't know what to expect. You know, then spent some time on the phone with Mark and met him in person. And he was not like what you would imagine an art forger running from the law might be. You know, he was charming and funny and constantly referencing old movies and television shows. And he's pretty wonderful. So,
But let's talk a little bit about his technique. Now, you follow him to Hobby Lobby and Kinko's, where he gets his supplies. Now, here is Mark Landis from the film talking about his techniques that have duped museum curators across the country.
Put it in one of those Walmart frames. Looks like $1 million. It does look like $1 million, because actually that's worth about $1 million. Maybe not quite that much, but close. And these frames are so cheap, and all you have to do is just go over them some with arts and crafts stuff, and they look really good. Don't you think that looks good?
Sounds like he's playing us a little. I mean, or is he a little proud of himself? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some pride there. It's, you know, Mark, as we got to know him more, you know, I think one of the things you realize about him is that there's this incredible mischievousness. It's not a maliciousness, but it is a mischievousness. And I think he took pride and enjoyment out of putting one over on folks with materials that, you know, are so common and so cheap. And he is unusual for so many different reasons. But this in particular, I think, is incredibly unusual for an art forger to not obsess about the materials and the means of production. You know, he was using cheap stuff because for Mark, it wasn't really about having, you know, the pieces have any sort of longevity in people's homes or the sale or any of these things. He was giving them away really for that moment of that interaction. So he could get in there, have that interaction with people and get away. And after that, he really didn't care. So, you know, if there was scrutiny afterwards to find the pigments were fluorescing under a blue light because they actually weren't period specific or whatever, it didn't matter to him.
And that's why he isn't in jail, is that correct? Because he never asked for money for these. He just gave them away.
Yeah. He didn't ask for money. He never took a tax write-off. This wasn't a planned intent to avoid the law. It just was, you know, it wasn't his interest.
Well, Mark Landis' father was a military officer. His family traveled a lot. He's pretty much obsessed with his mother and very much a product of the media age. Jennifer, you mentioned him always doing quotes from films. And in the film, we see the TV is always playing in the background. He's got loads of movie quotes. And you played on that with film clips throughout your film. How does this kind of illuminate his character? How did you use those?
As we began spending more time with Mark and then began watching the footage with co-director and editor Mark Becker, it became clear that Mark Landis's sort of whole world reference, you know, came through these old movies and television shows. It's such an important part of his life, and so we felt like it really should infuse the film as well. And, you know, it really, the TV is constantly on. It still is. You know, if we call him on the phone, he has to turn the TV down. And so I think using these clips were just a wonderful way to get into his head.
Well, Mark Landis had been diagnosed, he tells you early in the film, that he was hospitalized as early as age 17 and a long history of mental illness. Now, here he is reading his diagnosis. This is from a psych ward.
Schizophrenic, paranoid, and psychotic disorders. I got that. Personality disorders. I got that. Catatonic or other grossly disorganized behavior. I guess I've got that, too. It says I've got it. incoherence. Well, wait a minute. I didn't mean to laugh. I just, gee, that's awful. Oddities of thought, perception, speech, and behavior. Oh, no, I don't have that.
So he knows himself to a degree. Do you think that this art forgery was designed as a, I don't know, a way for him to cope with his mental illness?
I mean, I think certainly, you know, he taught himself to draw at an early age when he was a young child, and copying images out of catalogs from museums was a way for him to entertain himself when he was alone at night, and it was something he had a really good facility for. So within that background, you know, I think he really finds copying to be soothing, and he also, I think the art is both therapeutic, and then it's a means to an end in terms of, you know, getting to meet people through it.
We're speaking with Jennifer Grossman and Sam Cullman. They're directors of the documentary film Art and Craft. It's about one of the most prolific art forgers in U.S. history. Well, there is also this sense of humor. You know, there's an incredibly, as you said, he's charming, he's likable. There's a kind of gentleness to him. I felt a lot of sympathy for him and then thought, well, you know, it's not a victimless crime to donate art to museums, passing them off as real. But he's lying to people, right? You know, in this case, one museum curator, they're all across the country that have been completely taken. And he knows how to hit them, that soft spot, art and money, which is exactly what a con artist does. But he presents his intentions as really pure. What do you think?
Well, pure is a sort of a difficult word. I think there's a purity in anyone's intent as long as there is sort of no self-delusion. I think Mark is aware of how, at times, this ruse that he perpetrated was delusional. In other words, he talks openly in the film and in person as a human being that he would get carried away in this act. You know, I think he understands that what he did wasn't above board or necessarily right, but he sort of sees it as sort of harmless mischief and the kind of thing that for him gave him meaning. And so therefore this was his way in and his way to communicate with people. But certainly he does not see it the same way that, say, Matthew Leininger did, the person that, you know, discovered the ruse and sort of continued to track the case. You know, Matthew sees this as, you know, fully a wrong deed. You know, Mark sees it in more gray.
Well, and in the film, you present there, you know, Matthew Leininger is his kind of Javert, you know, chasing him down. He discovers the ruse, relentlessly trying to stop him. And you play these two off each other with this kind of noirish caper music, you know, revealing their shared obsessive qualities. So are you asking viewers to question here, you know, who is the good guy? Who's the bad guy?
I think what we wanted to do is start with ideas of people that, you know, face value maybe, and then deepen them as the course of the movie went on. And certainly this isn't a movie where we like to tell people what to think. And, you know, we've gotten reactions from one end of the spectrum to the other in terms of, you know, who thinks who is the villain and the good guy and who gets what out of the film. And some people find it hilarious and other people find it touching. That's been gratifying in that I think the work that Sam and Mark Becker and I put into crafting the film, you know, has allowed for people to question things that they might not necessarily question.
Well, this is all sort of building up to a meeting between the two of them. There's an exhibition of Mark's work. It's curated by Aaron Cowan at the University of Cincinnati, where they do meet. Now, did you know they were going to meet when you first started filming?
No, we didn't. But interestingly enough, as Jennifer said, Matthew was our first interview and first, you know, moment of filming for this project. And in the interview is a line that he says, he told us that he had this dream that he would put together an exhibition of Mark Landis's known forgeries and invite the world to come see them and invite Mark as the guest of honor. And he sort of laughs. And, you know, we sort of stored that in the back of our minds thinking like, wow, that would be amazing if that ever really were to happen. But, you know, we weren't thinking that it would. And, you know, spent the majority of the next year filming with Mark and keeping in touch with Matt. And then suddenly it all came together. Matt met, became reintroduced to Aaron. They had known each other, worked together previously, and together worked to set up the show. And it happened super fast. And thankfully, because we had already, you know, been introduced to Matt and stayed in touch, we were able to film it.
It must be very hard not to have a kind of expectation of what that scene is going to look like when they meet.
As a filmmaker and a human being, I think, you know,
yes.
I mean, geez, we, you know, there was this moment right beforehand where, you know, it's in the film and we're, you know, hanging out with Mark before he goes to this exhibition. And, you know, our hearts were in our throats as well because, and his was obviously way more because this was Mark's life. But, you know, the expectation was that he was going to be hung, you know, that this was going to be a public hanging in a sort of potential, like, you know, embarrassment for him. And things turned out somewhat differently. And maybe we should just leave it at that.
Well, he does. He has a tremendous anxiety beforehand. It really looks like a panic attack. And I wondered if during all the time that you spent with him, did you witness other maybe less pivotal displays of his illness that maybe you decided not to include? I mean, you spent a lot of time in the film, I think, helping us relate to him and understand him.
I mean, I think, you know, certainly the time we were shooting with Mark, his health was sort of up and down, both and not just his mental health, but his, you know, he wasn't taking such great care of himself. And so we were actually, you know, we were concerned about him and were in touch with Donna, who's in the film, his former caseworker. And, you know, it was interesting because after, you know, this build up to the exhibition, he sort of had this new lease on life. And even since the film, he's really come out of his shell in this way that we never anticipated and has been a lovely surprise, I think, for everyone involved, in that he's really enjoyed the film and the film's reception and talking about the film and traveling with it and getting to meet people all over the country. And so that's been sort of a wonderful byproduct that we didn't expect.
And he's doing his own work. It looks like, I'm looking at his website right now, he will commission, you can commission original works, have him copy a photo or a painting of maybe a family member or something like that. So he's signing his own work.
He is signing his own work now. And he's able to communicate with people online through their orders and through sort of comment boxes. And I think it's been really wonderful for him.
That's so ironic that people will want, you know, I want to have a Mark Landis of my own.
Yeah, that's why it's called MarkLandisOriginal.com.
Well, since the film has come out, you and you, both of you and Mark Landis have been on several panels. I know that you, with Colette Lull, presented the film for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and used him as an example of someone managing his mental illness through his artwork. Did you, when you started making this film, think that it would turn into a film about mental illness on some level?
When we first heard about the story, there was no mention of Mark's mental illness. And so, you know, we went in intrigued by the premise of an art forger who's giving away his fakes and wondering why on earth he would do that. And then, you know, once we met Mark and understood his diagnosis a bit and sort of his history, certainly we knew that mental illness was going to be a part of the film, and figuring out how to structure that within the sort of art heist story was something that Sam and Mark Becker and I spent a lot of time debating in the edit room. And we wanted the film to show the Mark Landis that we got to know over several years, which is, you know, not someone who's mentally ill, but he's his own person who happens to have mental illness. And I think that was important for us to convey and has seemed to touch people in the same way that we intended, which has been great.
Well, Jennifer and Sam, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
for having us.
Jennifer Grousman and Sam Kalman directed the film Art and Craft. It's about the art forger Mark Landis. It's now available on DVD and made its debut on POV and is now available to watch online. You'll find a link to watch the film at wordofmouthradio.org. And now, authenticity in the publishing world. Ever wonder how that busy celebrity or rock star or politician found time to write that memoir? Well, chances are they didn't. They hired a ghostwriter to do it for them. Ghostwriting is an integral part of the publishing industry that is kept mostly out of the spotlight. So producer Eric Malinsky is going to lead us on a ghostbusting mission.
Madeline Morrell is going to let you in on a secret.
On the nonfiction bestseller list, 12 out of the 15 books listed probably have been ghostwritten.
She should know. Morrell is a literary agent who only represents ghostwriters. Her clients have written books for authors like Mike Huckabee and Sarah Ferguson. Yes, author is the technical term for the celebrity whose name is on the cover.
You know, I'm really like a publishing matchmaker.
She sets up a date between the author and the ghostwriter that she thinks will fit their needs best.
But it doesn't always work. Sometimes the ghostwriter will decide they can't stand working with the author because a lot of authors are very exacting. You know, they don't quite understand that a ghostwriter is more than a glorified amanuensis.
I had to look that up too. It's an old word for a stenographer. Gene Stone has been ghostwriting for 20 years. For contractual reasons, he can't reveal the names of many of the authors that he worked with. But they include a movie star, a politician, a celebrity chef, and a big CEO. Writing somebody else's autobiography can be a very intimate experience.
You're a therapist, you're a brother, you're a father, you're a priest, you're a confessor.
Yeah, then you have to turn yourself into Meryl Streep. You have to then become them at the end of the day.
But I'm doing a really good job. When the book is done, it comes out, that person's friends say, hey, what did you need a ghostwriter for? I mean, it's just you.
That's why there's a lot of pressure to keep the ghostwriter invisible. Madeline Morrell likes to pretend that her clients are dying to see their names on the cover. But for a higher price, they'll stay anonymous.
It's a nice negotiating point, you know. All right, my client won't put their name on the cover if... It doesn't always work, because I think a lot of people are quite well aware of the fact that writers don't actually care that much. You know, I'm sure it's the writer's mother who cares more than the writer in many cases.
Right, so long as the ghostwriter's name is on the check. Here's another secret. If you want to know who really wrote the book, read the acknowledgments.
The more menial a task somebody is thanked for in a book, the greater chance it is that they actually wrote the entire book.
Barbara Feinman Todd always found the acknowledgments kind of demeaning.
If I get thanked for my good cheer one more time, I'm going to go postal. I am not full of good cheer, and I should not be thanked for it.
She also wasn't thanked for ghostwriting Hillary Clinton's 1996 bestseller, It Takes a Village. Republicans used that oversight against Clinton, and the former First Lady doubled down on her claim that she wrote the whole book. Barbara Feinman Todd, the ghostwriter, became a political football. But by that point, she was already disillusioned.
You know, one of the top three goals is not telling the truth. And I think that's a problem when you're selling a book and it goes in the nonfiction section in the bookstore.
So she quit. Now she teaches journalism at Georgetown.
As a journalist, I'm trained to use everything that's good. As a ghostwriter, you get the access that journalists can only dream of, but you don't have the control over the story.
But her students might have to resort to ghostwriting to pay the bills. The magazine and newspaper industries are shrinking, and blogs don't pay anything, or much. When Gene Stone started ghostwriting, he'd be embarrassed to tell journalists what he did for a living.
And whereas they once looked at me and said, oh, you're a ghostwriter, well, I have a real job. Now they're calling me up and going, how do I get into this ghostwriting thing?
Now, I talked with ghostwriters on the East Coast and the West Coast, and I noticed that the L.A. ghosts don't have that same sense of embarrassment. David Rinson wrote Chris Rock's book, Rock This, in Tim Allen's bestseller, Don't Stand Too Close to a Naked Man.
We came up with the title at lunch. He was telling me about being in prison, and I said, well, you don't want to stand too close to a naked man then. And he said, that's the title. Or maybe it was the other way around. I'll give him the credit.
Rinson prefers to be called a collaborator or co-author. He hates the word ghostwriter.
I don't think that writing with somebody is necessarily milquetoast. It can be, and I've seen plenty of books out there that are either whitewashes or trash talk, and I'm not interested in that. I really want the human being to come through.
Which is what we want from these books, to feel closer. Publishers seek out celebrities because they come with their own fan base, thousands of Twitter followers, their own cable shows. Again, here's Gene Stone.
It used to be that 20 years ago, they'd say, well, this guy's very telegenic. I like what he's saying. We can get him on Oprah. Now, the person comes in and says, what's your platform? How can you launch this book? What can you do to make this book happen?
Gene Stone worries that ghostwriting is perpetuating a myth that anyone can write a book, that writing isn't a specialized craft requiring a well-paid professional. This really hit home when he was watching a talk show once, and one of the celebrities he worked with said to the host,
oh, yeah, you know, I wrote the book in the shower. I wrote the book before breakfast. It was, people talk about how difficult it is to write a book, but it's actually very easy. And I thought, well, that's not true. You didn't do anything. But, you know, that's our culture.
Former ghostwriter Barbara Feinman Todd.
I cannot tell you how many times I've been contacted by people who say, everybody tells me I should write a book, that my story is amazing. You know, and a lot of people think they should write a book. It's therapy. And I say to you, find a good therapist. Do not find a good ghostwriter.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2012, a Canadian trauma surgeon was hit by a drunk driver and rushed to the hospital. She was pregnant with her 11th child and died shortly after the baby was delivered by emergency delivery. It was Mother's Day. The tragic death of Dana Durr is one of the saddest stories you'd ever hear, and thousands of friends and supporters were stricken with grief after her husband posted the news on social media. But Dana, her husband, and their 11 children never existed. They were the invention of a medical student in her young 20s. Taryn Wright is a futures trader by day, an internet hoax buster by night. She helped to uncover what is now referred to the Warrior Eli hoax and joins us to talk about the phenomenon sometimes referred to as Munchausen by internet. Taryn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So how did you uncover this hoax?
I was actually just, it was Mother's Day. I went on Facebook and one of my friends had posted about it. And I read the post that was linked by her, and I just thought, oh, my gosh, this is the saddest story. I'm very nosy, so I did a little Google search just to see what the people involved look like and noticed that there were no Google News results, which, I mean, the news media would have been all over that, a young mother dying on Mother's Day in a drunk driving accident. So that kind of is what made me suspicious of the whole thing.
Okay, so who's this Eli character that comes into it?
Eli was the Durr's young son who was, I believe, 7, and he was just slowly dying of cancer. And the family had kind of documented it in graphic detail on all their social media sites. They were on every single outlet as far as Facebook, Blogger, things like that. It was well documented for many, many years that this kid was sort of slowly wasting away and dying.
Well, once you did expose it, how did the people who'd been taken in react?
It was kind of like a bomb went off in the community. I mean, people just exploded and didn't trust anything or anyone. And honestly, when I wrote about the first hoax, I wasn't really prepared for how much it affected people when it came out that the story was not true. I heard from a mother who left the bedside of her dying child to comfort the Durr family when they had a diagnosis of remission in Eli. And now she's looking back and thinking, I left my kid to comfort this person, and this person isn't even real. They formed really intense friendships with the family, and I think that the people who did friend them, a lot of them were struggling with illnesses themselves or illnesses of a family member, and they're in a very vulnerable spot where anybody who's kind of going through the same thing is a friend to them. And to find out that this person wasn't real was very devastating.
So they were friending people in the Durr family, all one person pretty much. Who was the inventor of this Durr family hoax?
Well, it ended up being a 22-year-old med student from Ohio. She had started the family as kind of just a time killer when she was a teenager, and I believe it kind of just snowballed from there. She was interested in medicine and interested in childhood cancer, is something that she was passionate about, and she invented the characters and kind of got lost in this world and sort of lost the plot that there were real people whose lives she was affecting by the story. She and I ended up talking on the phone, and she confessed the whole thing. She apologized to everyone involved, and I do believe she really does feel terrible about it.
Was the Warrior Eli hoax more or less elaborate than others that you've uncovered over the past few years?
This one was particularly elaborate just because it went on for so many years. I mean, I found stuff on the internet going back at least 7 years. When I talked to the person who ended up being behind the hoax, she said it had been going on for 11 years. Something that made it really elaborate was that she had sent out packages to supporters that had a plastic bracelet to draw awareness to Eli's cancer fight. She had printed out pictures and stuff of Eli and wrote on the back and sent that out to supporters. And she sent them out at her own expense all over the world. So to me, that was pretty excessive. Since then, I mean, I've uncovered a lot of other hoaxes, and the people behind them do go to really, really great lengths to make their story seem believable. But that, to me, kind of stuck out, the care packages.
Well, you did publish a written apology from Emily on your website. How did people respond? Did they take it?
No, the response kind of shocked me. To me, I have sympathy for the people that are behind the hoaxes, because I don't think that anybody who's very happy with their life would make 72 fake Facebook profiles and invent a family that has a child that's dying of cancer. People that were affected by it didn't seem to feel like she was remorseful or that the apology was sincere. Eventually, I do think some people are able to forgive them, but it's difficult. I mean, it's really difficult when someone's been deceived and they discover they've been opening up and telling their most intimate secrets to somebody who's been lying about their very identity.
Well, you seem to have a little bit of sympathy for the perpetrators of the hoaxes.
I do. I mean, I don't think that anybody who is in a good place emotionally is doing these things. I've exposed now, I believe, 16 or 17 of these hoaxes. And every single time when I'm doing research, I think, oh, this person is terrible. I can't believe that somebody would do this. When I end up talking to the person behind it, I kind of hear their sad story, and I realize that they're not in good places. I mean, I honestly feel like a lot of them are depressed, and this is a way for them to take social risks without sort of having to step outside their comfort zone. Obviously, that doesn't make what they're doing right, but I do think it's possible to know what they're doing is wrong and to still have sympathy for the person that's doing it.
I'm speaking with Taryn Wright. In her spare time, she hunts down and exposes a very specific type of internet scammer, people who pretend to have serious or terminal diseases, sometimes for financial gain, but more often just for the attention. The condition has been called Munchausen by internet. Well, Taryn, now you work with a group of others, the Warrior Eli Hoax Group. Are these people like you who just kind of stumbled into this, or maybe people with a more personal stake or axe to grind because they've been taken in?
It's people that were affected by the first hoax, the Warrior Eli hoax. They were either friends of the Durr family, or they were people who were in the childhood cancer community who knew the Durr family just throughout, you know, the internet presence of that group. A lot of them, some of them are just researchers in general. Like it was a group that formed pretty organically after I posted on the blog. It was basically as people that are good at researching these things and are kind of passionate about making sure that people aren't hurt by a hoax like this again.
So do you surf the web looking for stories or people that sound suspicious?
They come to me usually. I get a lot of emails from people with different web pages and groups on Facebook to look at to attempt to verify the truth behind it. So we do get a lot of emails, and just every once in a while, just surfing the web on different blogs and stuff, something will pop up and will look fishy to me.
What are some of those fishy-looking or red flag kind of stories?
It's always just very, very dramatic. I mean, I think even in the most awful, terrible cancer battle, there's moments just of tedium and boredom and things like that. In the fake blogs, there's nothing like that. Every day, somebody is coding, somebody's going into a coma. If it's not the patient, then somebody close to them is getting in a car accident. There's always twins involved. Just like very, pretty much the most dramatic plot twists that you can think of always seem to happen in the fake blogs. Like if people are losing attention, it becomes like sweeps week where they have to have something dramatic happen to make the story kind of progress forward.
Well, this has
so
been
that's a definite red flag.
This has been happening for a long time, obviously before the internet. But how do you think that technology has changed or worsened even the nature of these kind of hoaxes?
Well, I just think it's a lot easier now for somebody to make something like this up. I've talked to Dr. Feldman, the psychiatrist who came up with Munchausen by Internet, and he said that if people weren't doing this online, they'd be going into hospitals and feigning illnesses to get attention. So I think now instead of having to research and actually take the risk of going into a hospital and maybe being found out, people can just turn on the computer and do 10 minutes of research about, you know, some sort of ailment and create a blog and start faking online. And it's just a little easier and less of a risk.
Imagine when looking for hoaxes, you also do come across a lot of real stories about cancer patients and grieving families and long hospital stays. And wonder, is it difficult for you to spend so much time rifling through such emotionally loaded material?
It is. You know, it's opened my eyes to the fact that people struggle a lot with stuff that I hadn't really given much of a thought to. I mean, childhood cancer, I had no idea what a terrible, I mean, I knew it was a terrible thing. I didn't know how widespread it was, and I didn't know exactly how horrific of a fight it is. I've friended a lot of people who I've interacted with while confirming hoaxes, and it's just emotionally loaded, and it's difficult to kind of walk the path of having sympathy for both sides of the aisle. You know, like I do know these people have been lied to, and I do feel terrible about that. And some people get angry at me for being sympathetic towards the people behind the hoaxes. So it's just kind of an emotional minefield signing online every once in a while now.
Well, Taryn, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Taryn Wright, she's a futures trader by day and internet hoax buster by night. She helped to uncover what is now referred to as the Warrior Eli hoax. You'll find a link to read a lot more about her work. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. We guarantee you will not find any fake stories or frauds or hoaxes at wordofmouthradio.org, unless we meant to do it, and they're marked as such. That is also where you can sign up for the Word of Mouth podcast, and you can listen whenever fits your schedule. And if you dig that kind of convenience, please do us a favor and write a review or rate it on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio. Thank you.